Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott. I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to noon, and you can also reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. We're also podcasting on iTunes and Podcast Alley and all those great sites, and hello to all our podcast listeners all over the world. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. Doing good.
We have gotten a lot of email.
Yes, we have. We get a lot of email.
Yeah, but some of it...
We like email.
Some of it's calling us dumb.
All right, I guess that email we don't like so much.
Here's the background. This is fair. Here's the background. We started a few shows ago, 20 Picks for 2006, which was a great article from the Philadelphia Inquirer on food trends.
I think we started this like six shows ago.
Yeah, but we're intermittently getting through the list, and I got an email last night. So will you get through the damn list? I want to see what the rest of them are. Okay, so here are some more food trends that the Philadelphia Inquirer spotted that we agree with.
Can we promise that this is the last?
Yeah, it's over.
We'll get to the end today.
9 minutes and we're over. Okay. Oh, by the way, next we have, in the rest of the segment, we have a winemaker joining us. A gentleman named Paul Hobbs, who's one of the most sought-after winemakers in the world, will be joining us a little later on.
I can tell you my favorite winemaker in the world.
Yeah, he's great. And he makes
apologies to George Hendry and some of my other friends, but my favorite winemaker in the world.
Well, and one of the interesting things about talking with Paul is he makes wine in Argentina, Chile, California, and now he's got a new project going on in the Tokaj region of Hungary. And so we're going to talk to him about making wine and the culture in all those different places, and I think that's going to be
awesome. He's always got good stories about the places he's been to.
So, food trends. Here's what the Philadelphia Inquirer says about food trends is coffees and chocolates are getting more bitter. Not as in the bad way, but even Hershey's Kisses and Kit Kat bars are coming out in darker versions. Some see the trend as part of an age-related change in tastes among the graying boomers, and others see it as a new acceptance and appreciation of complex and bitter flavors. Real chocolate lovers have always liked bittersweet chocolate. Milk chocolate's
good. And in Europe, these chocolates have always been available, and mass-produced the way some of the companies are mass-producing them here.
I think it actually is a sign of growing tastes. You know, your palates change as people get more into things. As you get more involved in wine, your taste goes from sweet to dry, and in coffee and chocolate and things, your taste goes. You accept the more bitter flavors.
Well, because what happens, one of the things that happens is you're really begin to look for that chocolate flavor as opposed to the sweet flavor which you were already accustomed to, but when you started eating chocolate, and then as you taste more and more chocolate, those bitter flavors become more and more palatable.
You know, if you live in Central Jersey, you live anywhere around New Brunswick, in Highland Park, there's a chocolate company called Byrne Chocolate.
Great family-owned
chocolatier. You know, very often when you get out and you get the big commercial...
Like a musketeer, the chocolatier.
No, chocolatier, if I want to be pretentious. But if
you wanted to be.
If you...
I've been your friend a long time.
All right, that's enough. A lot of the chocolate that you buy out there, it's sweet and nice, and it's sort of brown-flavored sweet stuff of a nice texture. But when you start to get into serious chocolate, I mean, it's the chocolate flavor itself that can be very, very complex, like coffee or wine. Byrne Chocolate, it's B-I-R-N-N.
B-I-R-N-N, yes.
We'll link that up on our site later on. We'll put you a link to Byrne Chocolate. And the factory itself is in Highland Park. They supply a lot of high-end chocolates that they can't tell you the name of who it is that they're actually contract making the chocolate for. But you can go to the factory store and just buy it direct, and it's really reasonable.
Yeah, they have a tiny, tiny little store in the middle of nowhere land of Highland Park in New Jersey.
In residential neighborhood, you find this little chocolate factory, and you go in this barely marked door, and you can buy chocolates.
But everybody from the area knows Byrne Chocolate. They've been around forever.
Right, Easter Sunday, Easter weekend, you can't get near the place. But it's really worth a try. Anyway,
all right, let's move on.
Coping with food allergies is becoming increasingly important. Celiac disease, peanut allergies, we see this in the restaurant all the time.
Sure.
And these are serious food allergies.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the allergies are, but what people are becoming more sensitive to. And I don't know if it's pesticides or something that we're putting in the fertilizer, but people are certainly becoming more acutely allergic to things than we ever were.
The Center for Disease Control says that allergies, food allergies, and especially acute food allergies are on the rise, like nut allergies, celiac mm-hmm. disease, things like that. And a lot of people point to what's changed in our diet since this has happened. And what's changed in our diet is we have a lot of processed foods,
mm-hmm.
and we don't know exactly what's in our food anymore.
Yeah,
and we talk about it in the show all the time.
You know, I have some food allergies and things like that, and I just got to mention it again because I think it's helped a lot of people. I take these pills from Shaklee, these alfalfa pills for lactose intolerance. And they totally solve that problem for me. And like I've said a couple times before on the show, it seems to me that of the people I recommend it to, about half of them have some kind of relief from these. And it's a simple alfalfa pill.
It's just alfalfa.
And you can buy alfalfa from GNC or whomever. The ones I use are from a company called Shaklee. But these alfalfa pills, and you could actually just eat alfalfa as well. But it's a great digestive. And that's, and it really helps with that particular problem.
Next topic is, here's what they, this is number 16.
You've heard enough of my lactose intolerance?
I'm done. I'm all done. Homegrown is chic is the 16th food trend for 2006. Fresh foods are the first choice of fine chefs, and what could be fresher than homegrown? Home cooks are now seeing more herb pots on windowsills, mm-hmm. kitchen gardens, things like that. And that's really great. And I'm seeing that among the foodies who come to the restaurant.
Sure. Well, back in I guess, March or April, we were talking about growing your own herbs at home and how you could go about planting your own herbs and having them for 6 months or 8 months, or even some of them, you know, you can have year round, or putting them on your windowsill inside your house. You don't need that much of them
mm-hmm.
to be able to make a dinner or two dinners or three dinners a week.
And also,
keep growing.
We're seeing more resurgence of people who grow their own tomatoes, and in August they're all mm-hmm. excited about their tomatoes. And we ourselves, I mean, for Catherine Lombardi, we put up 2,000 pounds of local tomatoes that we ourselves picked so that we could have local stuff. And that's good for the environment because it doesn't use fossil fuels to travel from here to there. And it's also the way to get the freshest food, because if I'm picking something that I know I'm going to cook that night, I pick it when it's perfectly ripe If I have to sell it or ship it, I've mm-hmm. got to pick it a couple of days earlier, a week earlier.
Any of you who have home gardens, you understand exactly what we're talking about. Whether it's a pear tree in your backyard, or a tomato plant that you grow, or fresh basil that you're growing in a pot in your windowsill, those things taste better when you get them as fresh as can be.
Next food trend for 2006 is more choices and more courses. More upscale restaurants are offering broad selections of cheeses, olives, chocolates, and ports as things like individual courses. And the cheese course phenomenon is mm-hmm. is incredible. And
it's been fun to watch. You know that when I was a kid, I spent a fair amount of time in Europe. I have an aunt who lives in Paris. And that phenomenon has been around in Europe forever.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just been kind of slow to catch
right.
on
cheese
to
course
it.
Cheese used to mean Cracker Barrel and Ritz crackers.
Yes, it did.
But more and more, you see people taking the time, and it is a great deal of expense to, and you need to learn a lot to be able mm-hmm. to handle a cheese board in a restaurant of 12 or 14 cheeses and have them preserved well, age well, and have a staff that knows about
it. And ripen at the right time and be served at the right time.
All right, we've gotten through the article of the 20 food trends from the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Only told you about the ones we really liked.
To all of those.
We skipped a bunch.
To all of those who emailed us imploring us to finish, we have now finished. Our guest starting in the next segment is Paul Hobbs, universally acclaimed on both sides of the Atlantic as one of the best winemakers in the world and our personal pick for our favorite winemaker. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We are here talking. We're going to be talking with our guest this show, Paul Hobbs. Paul is universally acclaimed by the critics on both sides of the Atlantic, who often disagree, but in this case they agree that Paul's one of the best winemakers in the world. He makes his namesake Paul Hobbs wines in California, but he's also got his name on some of the most important wines in all of South America, the Catena wines he helped to originate, and Cobos wines, both in Argentina and Chile. And he's currently working on a new project in the Tokaj region of Hungary. He will be hosting a dinner featuring his hard-to-find wines and some impossible-to-find wines from his cellar and ours at Stage Left on January 31st. If you want to come, you can, but reservations are required. And you can go to stageleft.com for more info. So hi there, Paul.
Good morning, Francis. How are you?
Paul, how are you today? It's great to hear your voice.
Doing great. How are you?
We're doing pretty well.
It's early for you, friend. You okay?
Yeah. The sun just peeking up over the horizon.
Yikes. Now, how does it feel to be a member of what is increasingly being referred to as the Flying Winemakers Club, flying from on three, making wine on three continents?
You know, it's funny. I really don't think of myself as a flying winemaker.
Well, you don't actually fly yourself with wings.
Not yet. No. But, you know, I've been doing that kind of travel for the better part of 16, 17 years now since I started working in South America. And it's just part of it. I don't know. I don't think much about that part.
Well, now you're on three continents, right? So you just started a project in Hungary?
That's right.
Yeah, when last,
also in the southern part of Hungary.
When last we spoke, or at least had dinner together, you were on your way to Hungary. You were actually, you were stopping in New York on your way to Hungary, and we were like, so what's winemaking like in Hungary? And you said, I'll tell you in a couple weeks. Well, tell us. What's going on?
Well, essentially, it's as you know, it's been under communist rule for quite some time, so it's just coming out from under that cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great opportunity. I mean, during that period of time that it was with communism, during that period of time, it's been pretty much a lot of what was great about the area was lost.
Mm-hmm.
High production kicked in, and high-end or fine winemaking was pretty much lost. So we're really looking right now to bring it back to its original grandeur.
Yeah. I think people may not realize, and a lot of our listeners, I think, I'm sure, don't realize, that Hungary was one of the greatest wine-producing regions of the world at one time.
Well, and they had one wine in particular, which is the Tokaj Aszú from the Tokaj region of Hungary that was considered without rival. I mean, its only rival was probably the Tokaj Aszú and the Essencia, which is from the same region and the same grape, were rivaled by Chateau Yquem, which is considered now the greatest dessert wine in the world. But, you know, that was just one of the greatest wines in the world was simply lost and screwed up. I mean,
absolutely.
Have you had a lot of pre-war Tokajs? Because some of those wines are still around and alive. Have you tasted
pre-war? I've had a couple of them. I wouldn't say a lot of them, but there's still a number of beauties housed in these grand old cellars that are more than 500 years old. And they're absolutely marvelous wines.
When we say pre-war, by the way, we're not talking about Gulf War.
Right, we're talking about World War II. Now,
yeah, I figured.
can that region come back? I mean, what was lost? What was changed? What did the communists do differently? And what can we get back?
Well, I think that the region can come back, and that's one of the reasons I'm so interested in it. Of course, you know, it's part of the European community, but it's not part of the Euro area, meaning that they don't. At least at present, they're still working with their own currency,
which
and
is a foreign
with the euro. And so, I think there's a great opportunity for investment. There's a huge interest in bringing the area back to its and even taking it beyond where it was. But what was lost was a lot of the techniques, a lot of the passion for making high-end wines, and it was totally turned over to a high production variety.
Right, the wine that once was handmade and made by artisans became only made by factories.
Pretty much.
Actually, it became made by one factory called Hungaroven, which was all Hungarian wine production went through one factory, and it was all horrible. They used to boil their wines occasionally, pasteurize them, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I've heard horror stories. I mean, but they were essentially faceless wines, just plunk, really.
Right.
And so a lot of the equipment, there's still some of the old casts, but essentially most of what was useful in making great wines was destroyed.
Can I tell you that's one of my favorite wine descriptive words?
Plonk.
It's a great word. It really says it all. You don't even need to know the definition. It says exactly what it is.
So when you go back to make wine in a place like Hungary that had this centuries-old tradition of making some of the greatest wines in the world, and then 50 years of a blackout, are there still, I mean, are there historical references to how wine was made? Are there still old guys who know how wine was made? I mean, how do you reference the past, the pre-World War II history?
Yeah, it seems as though there's a few folks that either hung on or went into other industry, but now have come back into it, either their sons or... So there is some knowledge, and then, of course, there's all the new technologies that are available as well. And I think there was some good written notes and so on that were kept, but they just kind of be bubbling up to the surface. Mm-hmm. It's not like there was a library that was, you know, available, and so it's just sort of a lot of it anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people are kind of talking and getting together and kind of sharing some of the stuff and rebuilding what they knew or the old stories and that kind of thing. So And then there's just an injection of the new technologies, and that's part of the reason I'm there and kind of helping bring that to the table.
Our guest is Paul Hobbs. He's one of the greatest winemakers in the world on three continents, and we're talking about his new project in Hungary. We'll be talking more with him about Argentina and California in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:25. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back at the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis. Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. He's one of the greatest winemakers in the world, and that's not just me saying that. The best wine critics in the world on both sides of the Atlantic agree that Paul is one of the greatest winemakers in the world. We're talking about your new project that you have in Hungary. What are you doing there, Paul? What are you making out in Hungary? Can you tell us?
Yeah, sure. Well, we're making the classic Tokaj wines, which, as you've already mentioned, the Six Botoños, the Azu wines, the Esencias, and but already that's come back, you know, 90-95% where it once was, or even in some cases even better.
So. And again, those are the sweet wines of Hungary.
Those are the sweet wines.
It's super exciting because it's one of the greatest wines the world had ever seen that disappeared for 50 years and now it's back, and that's amazing.
It was known as Wine of Kings for a long time.
Wine of Kings.
So what else are we doing out there?
We're also working. I mean, the people of that region believe that, you know, just going on sweet wines alone won't be enough, and so there's an effort to make dry wines, and that's really groundbreaking because the area is full of this mold, botrytis, and so it's going to be interesting to see whether or not we can also make dry wines that are clean and fresh and fruity.
Botrytis, just so everybody knows, is the good mold that you look for in order to make sweet wines.
Exactly. And there's so much of it there that, and we don't want that to make dry wines.
Right.
Right.
So that's going to be one of the tricks, if we can pull that off. There's a feeling that that's the only way the area will survive, that even on its history of great sweet wines, that enough will not be enough to sustain the area.
And how about red wines from Hungary, Paul?
They're... several areas that are interesting, but I'm only familiar with one intimately, and that's in the southern part, an area called Vilaine, and it's right down near the Croatian-Serbian border, and most of what I've worked with thus far are Cab Francs and Cabernet Sauvignon. It's a warm area, and there's some great slopes, so we're planting new vineyards. So most of what's going on there, at least what we're doing, is fairly new.
I think,
but the area does have some pedigree as well.
I think that one of the most exciting countries in the world to watch is going to be Hungary as its economy returns and its culture returns, and it finds its place again one more time as one of the greatest wine regions in the world. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Paul about his wines from Argentina, which have been called the best wines produced ever in the history of Latin America, and his cult wines from California as well. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, as well as Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. He is a universally acclaimed restaurant critic on both sides of the Atlantic. He makes wine in Argentina and in California and in Hungary. His Argentine and California wines are very sought after, very hard to find, and very expensive, Paul. He will be hosting a dinner featuring some of these hard-to-find gems at Stage Left Restaurant on January 31st. If you want to come, you can, but reservations are required. You can go to stageleft.com or restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll tell you how to do that. Hey there, Paul.
Hey, Paul. So explain something to me, Paul. You're about 34, 35 years old. It's the late 80s. You're the winemaker at CIMI. You've been a winemaker on the Opus One project. And you're really starting to make a name for yourself in California. So you decide to go to Argentina and start all over again.
Maybe it's a little bit like Tiger Woods changing his swing.
Yeah, and by the way, just, you know, there's this Argentine craze was pretty much, I mean, a lot of people give you the credit for kicking off the Argentine wine craze. Because even when people were making wine in Chile, the conventional wisdom was there was nothing in Argentina not worth going to.
We're on that list, by the way, Paul. We're giving you the credit for that.
So you go to Argentina where everybody else says, it's not worth going to. What do you find there, and then what makes you decide to stay and make wine there?
Well, it was totally serendipitous. I just went over there because at the insistence of Nicholas Catena's younger brother, Jorge, whom I went to school with, and what I found when we got over the mountains was an extraordinary great soils, gravelly soils that were beautiful for vineyard. And so what I was most concerned about was the climate, whether it would be too hot or not. And the only way to figure that out was to actually be there and make wine for a period of time.
Uh-huh. And, well, what was the state of Argentine winemaking when you went there, though? I mean, was anybody making good wine? Why didn't no one see it before you?
I'm not sure. I don't really know what happened. I know some folks had come from California, but that didn't work out. I'm not sure if anybody else was coming from France or other parts of the world. So it was just something, it was one of those strokes of good luck for me, I guess. I happened to be at the right place at the right time, and I don't know what else to say about it than that. I mean,
well, so you go over there and you start making wine with Nicholas Catena, and I mean, did you receive immediate acceptance? Did the consumers there accept you? Did the other winemakers and property owners there accept you, or did you encounter some resistance when you first went over there?
No resistance at all, but we kept the thing under wraps for 3 or 4 years. Actually, it took the state of their wineries and the state of wineries in general. Most of the expansion had finished in 1930. By 1930, there hadn't been any really new development in wineries, so technology and equipment was in a horrific
state. Was 60 or 70 years old? Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, in the 1930s, I mean, that was the last time. So how old was it? 60 years old?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it was really antiquated historical stuff, actually. It was stuff I hadn't seen even in museums in France.
So what you saw in museums in France was what they were actually using in Argentina?
Yeah.
All right,
as a matter of fact.
So
most of the equipment that they had, most of that equipment had been copied from European equipment. So it was poorly made copies. It didn't really work that well.
So how do you get from there, which is with antiquated equipment, with people who don't really have any skill making wine, to where you are now, which to my mind, you've now made the greatest wine, Cobos 2003, you've now made the greatest wine ever made in the Southern Hemisphere. So how do you get from here to there?
Yeah, well, it's a painstaking approach, and most of it is training people and just learning how to work with the lay of the land. So, I think, I had the privilege of working with really good people, very bright people, that were obsessive and dedicated as I was to making a great product. And also one of the things that, to our advantage, we had to have a great place to do it. And so we sought out the best places in Mendoza, in the mountain. In a lot of those places, some of them had already been planted, so it was just a simple matter of going back in and re-trellising or resetting up the vineyards, but not having to pull them out and start from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives us, like with Cobos, for example, the opportunity to work with vineyards that are more than 80 years old.
And, yeah, and that's really important to great wine, is older vines.
Let's talk about this wine. Let's talk about this wine, Cobos, which is made from a grape called Malbec, which was once blended into a lot of Bordeaux and is now planted primarily in Argentina. And it's not a Cabernet Sauvignon, it's its own grape. And Paul, you had this idea that you were going to make the greatest Malbec in the world, and now you have with the 03 Cobos. In reading the story of this, because we've been friends for a long time, Mark and Paul and I have been friends for a long time, you start with the 98. In the 98, everything's washed out by rain. In 99, you made an amazing, amazing wine, which I still have a few cases of in my cellar. But you also contracted to buy fruit from some other people, and you tended the vine all season, and then they sold it out from under you.
That's right. That happened.
And so then, you were supposed to make more amazing wine, but somebody else got those grapes.
Right, because you farmed the grapes all year.
That was a rough lesson, obviously. Mm-hmm. That happened. We were working under contract with some high end growers, and then at the very last minute, because of hailstorms that happen in that area, the growers can be very, very touchy if they see what they feel to be a threat, and we weren't ready to pick, so they just went to somebody else and picked the grapes.
Unbelievable. So what's funny here and remarkable, and I think this is very telling of Paul as not just a someone who's tending to the grapes, but somebody who's a terrific winemaker. We never heard about those other grapes. We've never heard about the wine that they went into. We've never, I have no information on where those grapes went, because obviously they didn't go into a spectacular wine like Cobos.
So now we have the story of Cobos, where you start this new project. 98, you get rain, you lose the harvest. 99, you don't get half of the fruit you worked all year to get. In 2000, there is devastating hail, and hail in Mendoza is supposed to be, incredible, and it ruins the harvest completely.
Well, I love the one characterization of, not only were there no more grapes on the plant, all the leaves were knocked off.
Yeah, totally stripped. I mean, it looked like wintertime.
And then in 01, you get a great harvest again, and Argentina defaults on its debt, and the banks close, and there's no more money left in your account. Did you ever think God didn't want you to make this wine?
There was a time. It's weird because, what happened in the years that I was working for Catena, we had nothing but great vintages, and everything went smooth. Mm-hmm. So then when I set off on my own, I thought, okay, at least we're going to get some good luck, and I'll have some, and it went all the other direction. So it was disheartening, to say the least.
How do you come back as a winemaker when the country defaults on its debt and then the banks close and then when they open up again, all your money? How does that
work?
Well,
good thing, we lost a little bit of money, but not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And we most of what we had was invested in barrels and stuff, so we didn't have money sitting around in banks. So we were okay for the most part. We didn't lose too much.
What you're saying is, fortunately, we were poor. So
yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And absolutely true.
And so the demand for Cobos has been incredible. Now, you made some less expensive ones, of course, as well, but we're talking about the best one you make, which is now going for it's the 01 Cobos is the current vintage?
03.
03.
03. 03 is the current vintage. We're talking like $150 a bottle retail, right?
Yes,
I'll tell you, Paul, and I wasn't just blowing smoke before when I've recently opened up a bottle of the 03, and I truly believe it is the best Southern Hemisphere. Forget Australia, forget Chile, forget the other places in Southern Hemisphere making wine. It is the best, and I don't like to make
blanket statements
like that, but it is my favorite Southern Hemisphere wine that I've ever had.
But here's my question:
thank you very much, Mark.
$150 a bottle from Argentina, sold out.
It's nearly sold out, yes.
That's sold out. Stop it. Anything you have left, send to me.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Paul Hobbs. He's one of the greatest winemakers in the world. He makes wines in Hungary, in Argentina, in Chile, and in California. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. Paul's one of the best winemakers in the world. He makes wine on three continents, in North America, South America, and also in Europe. And, Paul, you have the very beautiful and charming young daughter, Agustina Hobbs. And you're very much a family man, and I know that you're very focused on spending as much time with her as you can. How do you balance making wine on three continents and having a family?
Well, interestingly, she loves to travel. So whenever she's not in school, she's usually traveling with me. So she's here currently. She lives in Mendoza and school's there, but right now it's summer there, so she's on summer vacation and currently at the Sonoma Country Day School. But she goes to Hungary. She's been there a couple of times with me, and she loves wine and tasting wine.
Well, We were happy enough to have her at our last wine dinner with you. We were happy that you brought her.
Are you bringing Augustina to the upcoming dinner?
There's no way I could leave her behind.
Oh, great.
That's great news.
She's coming.
That's terrific. If you want to meet Augustina and Paul Hobbs, and Paul is the second best person to meet in that little colloquium, you can come to Stage Left. The dinner's on the 31st of January.
I guess we better pour some of the Cuvée Augustina, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I got a funny story to tell you. Paul named his top cuvées, and I remember that I was walking in the vineyard with you before you had made the wine, and you pointed to a couple of rows of vines the year that Augustina was born. And the grapes were harvested the year Augustina was born. It was 2 years later where the wine was about to come out, and Paul said, I have this Cuvée Augustina coming, and it's going to be, I don't care what it costs, it's just going to be the best wine I can possibly make. And I thought, I know the family, I have to buy it. I hope it's good because it's going to be expensive. But we bought it every year since, so that worked out. Well, that worked
That's
out
right.
pretty well.
And it has been spectacular every year.
So when you traveled all these different places, Paul, Robert Parker has called you. He said, Paul Hobbs is like a good truffle-hunting dog when it comes to finding great vineyards.
Is that a compliment? I'm trying to figure it out.
I'm undecided myself.
I like truffles. I like dogs. Well, I don't know if I want to be a truffle-hunting dog.
Now, what he means by that, of course, for those of you who don't know, Robert...
A truffle-hunting pig.
Robert, yeah, I guess that's true. Robert Parker is one of the finest wine critics in the world, and a truffle-hunting dog is a dog that finds those very expensive tubers underground. And what he's saying is that Paul finds these great vineyard sites that other people just don't see. And and what do you look for in a vineyard or a place that other people seem to miss, but you seem to turn into gold?
Well, my father taught me about, the idea of terroir on our upstate New York farm. Mm-hmm. We have six or seven apple farms in that area. And so I grew up in agriculture, and my father's passion for the land and the subtle uniqueness and distinctions from one site to the next. And then, I was educated by the folks at Mouton during the Opus One project as well, in the late years of 1970, of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some of those were great experiences for me. And what I look for, of course, is first the soil and the site and the exposure, but also you need climate and you need people. I mean, it's all encompassing in that sense. So if it's a place that you don't really find the right ingredient in any one of those areas, then I tend to shun it. But I love doing that kind of thing. There's really interesting, I think Washington State holds great promise, for example, and there's other areas I'm very interested in as well. So that's one of the exciting things about what I do, I think.
I want to go back to just something you just touched on 1 second ago. Do you see a difference in apples from one orchard to the other through the different orchards that you had as a kid?
My father convinced me that I thought that I could, and it's one of those things, maybe it was suggestive, but I felt that because we had heavy clay soils in one area and very stony soils in another, I felt I could taste the difference.
And a star was born.
It's funny.
My father was convinced. Even the crispness of the apple, it was altered by the site.
There's a French term for that when they talk about and it's sort of hard to translate. There's no English term that gets it exactly right. It's sort of a sense of place that a grape wine from grapes grown in this part of a vineyard or this vineyard will be different than in that vineyard just because you taste the soil. And the French call it terroir, but you talked about your father and you quoted your father in a recent article in the LA Times. And this is how I'm going to explain terroir forever from now on. And you say that your father used to say, what comes out of the ground tastes like the ground it comes out of. And I thought, wow, that's exactly what it's about. That's the American way to say terroir. I mean, you learned a lot from your dad, didn't you?
I really did. He was a great, he was a lot of fun and a great mentor. So I was very lucky to have such a fabulous father.
Yeah, well, now you have your brother working with you. That's great. You've really made it a family business.
Yep. Matt's with me as well. He's number 10 out of the 11 children that my folks had.
Catholic family, everybody. Catholic family.
We're building after the war, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're talking with Paul Hobbs. He's one of the greatest winemakers on three continents. He's going to come and do a dinner at Stage Left with us a week from Tuesday. And we'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Paul Hobbs. He's our favorite winemaker in the whole world, and he's one of the most famous winemakers in the whole world. And we were talking before the break about, Paul, how you got your start. Now, you make, you know, wine that people, you know, can't get. I mean, you know, kings and princes fight over your wine.
$300 a bottle wines.
You started out as a rich man, right? You were son of a rich man?
Hardly.
tell us about growing up.
I was in a barn for part of my youth.
Tell us that story. I'd love for the listeners to hear where you came from a little bit.
Well, you know, that was in the 50s. I was born in 53, and by 1959,
Paul looks like
she did this, but already had was six children.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so. My oldest brother is a year older than I am. He was born in 52. At any rate, in 59, we had just an extraordinarily poor harvest on the farm, and as I understand it, my folks had about $1,500 in their pocket after the harvest of 59. And in the winter, that winter, 59-60, my dad thought, well, maybe investing some of the market in the stock market might be a way to expand that a little bit, but it went the other way on him. And we got to the point of being busted. So what my folks decided that the thing to do was to pile us in our station wagon, our big Ford station wagon, and we drove to Mexico, to Guadalajara, a little lake there area called Chapala, and we lived there through the winter. Rented the house for income, our home, and my father came back and lived in the barn through the winter and worked the farm with the hired men that were needed to prune the apple trees during the winter time. And then after the snow season was over, we came back with Dad. That was like late March, early April of that in 1960, and lived in the barn. All of us lived in the barn at that point. And, you know, so a little house on the prairie.
and just another story of how easy it was has been for the American farmer.
And so, we really enjoyed it. I mean, as kids, I was only like 6 or 7 years old, so it was a blast from my point of view.
And did your dad get to see some of your success as a successful winemaker?
He did. Unfortunately, he passed away 3 years ago.
Oh.
And so he's missed some of that. We're building a winery in Argentina today, and the work that I'm doing in Hungary are things that he would have loved to have been a part of. I did have the good fortune to take him to Argentina.
Wow.
Some years ago, so he got to see but that was at the very beginning of the what was going on.
I'm sure his spirit is living on with you. Hey, Paul, we have come to the end of our show. I want to thank you for joining us. If you want to meet Paul Hobbs and his daughter Augustina, you can come to Stage Left a week from Tuesday and meet them both and taste some of these wines that are impossible to find. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.